Well, whether it is or not, what we're going to do now in these precious minutes together is to look at that passage. I think we should look actually a bit further back in chapter 26 to verse 58. Peter followed him at a distance. Maybe that gives a hint as to what was wrong in this situation. Peter's there, he's going following Jesus, but there's a distance. Something has separated him from his leader. And I detect here in this passage something of the anatomy of a spiritual collapse. As Paul rightly said earlier on, we don't point the finger at Peter and say, oh, look at him, a hopeless letdown. Because most of us know what it is in one way or another, if we're Christians at all, what it is to let down Christ. So we look at this for a few moments. The story is reaching its crisis point. The crisis point, really, for the entire apostolic band. Earlier on the Thursday evening, Jesus had warned them, in Matthew 26, verse 31, that you will all fall away because of this night. Peter had then spoken up saying, oh no, I'll never fall away. I'll never let you down. I'll die for you, he said. But Jesus there in verse 34, Matthew 26, I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, this very night before the cock crows, you will disown me three times. And now Thursday is about to turn into Friday. The grab for the carpenter preacher has been made in a surprise night raid in the Garden of Gethsemane. Judas, the traitor, he's done his work for the moment and he's disappeared. Jesus is now a captive in the high priest's house. It's a place, actually, that has been excavated. You can visit it today. In old Jerusalem, you climb up the same ancient steps that Jesus would himself have been led up. Well, the trial of Jesus is on. And a second trial, in a way, that of Peter, has also begun right there by the fireside, a moral trial. It's your trial also, my trial, as we look at this passage, because it investigates us somewhat. We identify with Peter, if we possibly can, as he sits there in the courtyard of the high priest there, an unrecognized disciple among Christ's enemies, and feeling acutely uncomfortable. Peter's about to collapse under the pressure, and as we consider this process, the anatomy of this collapse, we do see ourselves too in a 100 different, but maybe similar, situations. Some prominent, some trivial, where the pressure to merge in with the crowd and kind of hide, you know, any discipleship that we have has been too much for us and we've disowned our leader. First of all, we see the Apostle Peter disorientated. That's my first stage, I think. So Matthew 26 and verse 40. Then Jesus returns from the Garden of Gethsemane, from prayer, to his disciples. He finds them sleeping. Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? He asked Peter. He puts it to him. And I think that explains quite a lot. He's urged his friends to keep alert, finds them asleep. Couldn't you watch? Then comes the bewildering arrest, a single frantic act of bravado by Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane. There it is in verse 51. When he reaches for his sword, he's got a sword. And it's John chapter 18 that names him as the one who actually drew the sword on the high priest's servant. Matthew's too tactful to say it was Peter. You know, he just said one of them drew the sword, but it was Peter. But then Peter wasn't thinking straight at all that night. He'd just woken up. You know, had not been praying, not alert, not vigilant. Suddenly, in come the lanterns and the people with the staves and the weapons to take Jesus, and Peter is caught totally off guard. He's disorientated. And in the state of disorientation, he's really a fumbling shadow of the great apostle who had acclaimed Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah and Son of the living God back in Matthew 16. He'd forgotten those earlier amazing experiences with Jesus. The healing of Peter's own mother-in-law. Somehow he'd forgotten all that. The raising from death of Jairus' daughter, the feeding of the 5,000 by Lake Galilee, or the stilling of the storm at just a word, the walking on the water, the Mount of Transfiguration when Jesus was lit up before the three disciples, Peter, James and John. The raising of Lazarus from the dead, he seemed to have forgotten it. And Christ's own words of prediction earlier on about Peter's denial, and Peter's insistent claim that he would always stick with Jesus. It hits us too, really. The 14th century German mystic Thomas a Kempis writes, "Oh, how great is human frailty, which is forever prone to evil. Today we confess our sins, and tomorrow commit the same sins again. This hour we resolve to be vigilant, and the next act as if we had never resolved at all." So here is Peter, prayerless, forgetful, disorientated, and so he lands this blindly aimed blow at the servant of the high priest and cuts off his ear. It's Luke, the doctor, who in his gospel adds that it was the right ear. He sort of notes these facts medically. I sometimes thought, actually, for a right-handed man to slice off the right ear of a person in front of him would actually require a very unorthodox action, something like the American twist service in action in tennis. Anyway, it would have been very awkward. Blindly, suddenly, this man has been injured, and then Jesus heals him. And Jesus has to correct Peter. "Look, we don't go in for swords in this game. People who think that they can put with the world right and achieve spiritual results by force, while they're resorting to methods that Jesus has ruled as totally archaic. The idea of the jihad, the holy war, is right out. Jesus rules it right out." So here now in the courtyard by the fire, trying to collect his rushing thoughts, now we see Peter thoroughly disoriented. He's got to the high priest's house and he's inside. So that's the first thing, disorientated. Step two, distanced. Well, we had it there in verse 58, following him at a distance. And there it seems to be continuing, at least mentally so. Peter had followed him at a distance. It seems that John, the apostle, the disciple, was already in the high priest's house. So we learn that from John chapter 18. And evidently it was John who spoke to the girl at the gate, who then let Peter in. But somehow, once inside, Peter seems to have become separated from John. So he joins the wrong lot. He's sitting with guards at the fireside, disorientated and somehow distanced. Friends, it is the isolated believer who becomes the vulnerable believer. See, why do we bother about things like fellowship? Why bother to come to this? Why bother to get to church? Why bother to come to a Bible study? Why bother about that Tuesday morning Bible study? When actually you could sit in your own bed, sit with your own Bible in front of you and do it with a box of chocolates on your own. No, the reason why we do it together is that we need each other. And being with others helps us to keep firm and stronger. It rubs off one from the other. Here's Peter, who's isolated. And he might have been all right if he'd stayed there with John at his side, but there in the glow of the firelight, surrounded by Jesus' enemies, he was a ready candidate for collapse. Disorientated and distanced. And thirdly, disguised. That's the third thing I noticed. The person who is described in those earlier electric days as the rock man, that's what Peter was called by Jesus. "You are Peter, the rock. And on this rock I will build my church." And he was looking ahead to the time when Peter's preaching at Pentecost would bring those 3,000 people surging into the kingdom. You know, that's what he calls him. But now here he is in a circle of alien hostility to Christ. I mean, we mustn't misunderstand this. Of course there's a case for going right into enemy territory, spiritually. Of course there is. Jesus did it himself, mingling freely with the tax collectors who are so crooked, and others, the Galilean underworld. Jesus would meet with them. I can think of others who could do that today. I can think of a London City missionary, Lionel Ball. He's retired now from it, but I remember him describing how he once went into a Soho sex shop because he thought, I must minister there, I must bring my witness. He said, I shook all over before going in. And he said, I armed myself with prayer, but he said, I was shaky. I think of my cousin, Robert DeBerry, he's a vicar in London. He went into one of these sex shops when he was in a vicar in Sheffield. And he went in with armed with his parish magazine, with his dog collar firmly on. And he said, I wonder if I could leave my parish magazine with you. And I said, oh, it's fine, thank you very much. And he thought, I'll do it again. The following month, he did the same thing, went in parish magazine. Third month, kept it up. Gradually, he made friends with the sex shop owner. And eventually, led him to a firm faith in Jesus Christ. The sex shop is no more. And the man who owned it, you know where he is? He's a missionary in Africa today. It shows that it can be done, mingling with those, but you need strength. You need fellowship alongside of you, lest you succumb and go down. Here is Peter. He shouldn't actually have been there. The atmosphere was probably one of criticism and mockery and jeering about the arrested preacher, and Peter was right there in it. So, the Christian in disguise, see, is quite a different matter from the Christian going in boldly, armed and with help at hand. Here he is in disguise, a Christian with a low profile, making business deals, mixing in society, commuting into daily work, and no one need ever know that we are disciples of Jesus Christ if we keep our heads down. D.L. Moody, the great American evangelist, once said, I pity anyone who lives so that people have to ask, is he a Christian? So is there some little giveaway tag, some little mark of identification? This person is a believer. In their language, their attitude, whatever it may be, their standards. We certainly need to pray for public figures who make their faith known in a humble but definite way in the public arena. I can think of people like Wendy Craig, the actress. She sometimes has come here, but she has her own church out, I think, in Chesham. But she doesn't mind letting it be known. And we have to remember people like them so that they will keep intact and keep bold and strong, wise. Here's Peter with the wrong people around him, disorientated, distanced, and disguised. Fourthly, dissociated. I'm looking here at verse 69 now. Of course, Peter was sitting out in the courtyard and the servant girl comes to him. You also were with Jesus of Galilee, she said. So suddenly, without warning, a mask is torn from Peter's face. From an unlikely quarter, and he dodges the challenge with a lie. No, I haven't done that at all. The challenge is repeated in verse 71, and then again in verse 73, and it's in John 18 that we learn that one of the speakers who joined in with that was a slave of the high priest, so a relative of the man that Peter had attacked out there in the garden. So he recognized him all right. Oh, you're one of them. And, you know, you speak like them. Then the old Peter, Simon, the son of Jonah, Simon, the rough fisherman, the tough Galilean, suddenly reemerges. And all the old language that Peter thought had been flushed into the past when he began with Jesus Christ, it surges back, verse 74, with a cascade of rich oaths. And in a flash, the great confession of Matthew 16, when he said, you are Jesus, the Christ, Son of the living God. The great confession is now succeeded by the great denial. And the incident is just another reminder to every single one of us that men and women are often brought down in their faith, not at their weakest points, but at their strongest points. The Bible is full of it. Noah, that upright, righteous man, they called him a preacher of righteousness, blameless in his generation, is found shortly after his successful negotiation with the flood, flat on his back, blind drunk. Or Moses, the man of unswerving obedience. Remember how at the end of his great career, he gives way to a fit of angry disobedience to God and forfeits his right of entry to the promised land. Or earlier on, Abraham, the precursor of believing people everywhere fails at his strongest point. His faith as he makes arrangements for Hagar, the alien Egyptian, to be a surrogate mother for the long-promised gift of a child from God. So at that point, suddenly, he fails. Oh, he recovers, but at that point, he's failing. Or David, the psalmist, who in his poems and generous exploits epitomize love, fails in this great virtue as he turns to lust in his pursuits after another man's wife. You and I, are we different? No, we're not different at all. Not at all. So what's your strongest point as a Christian? It's just there that we may be brought down at some point or other. We must learn to guard ourselves there, even at the strongest points, in case, like Peter, we become, against our best desires, dissociated from Christ. So those are the four D's. Disorientated, distance, disguised, dissociated. Actually, I've got a last one. Discredited. Verse 75. There it is. So immediately a cock crowed. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken before the cock crows. You'll disown me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. Here is Peter, whose name invariably comes at the head of the list of disciples. You know, always Peter, James, and John. Just as Judas's name always came at the end. Peter, who's told that on the rock of his faith and the preaching of Christ's eternal word, the church was to be built. Peter, who was to feature in the explosion of the New Testament church in the Acts of the Apostles. It's Peter who stumbles out blindly into the night of the Thursday that had become Friday. Good Friday. Crucifixion day. Most important day in Jesus' life. Discredited and defeated. Forever, so it seemed to him. No, it wasn't forever, but it seemed like that. So there's the anatomy of a breakdown, and it's all there in Matthew 26. We can't turn on Peter. We want to sit down beside him, really, in the darkness, and say, Peter, you're going to get back. Peter, you don't realize you've just been by that fireside. The day will come, not many days hence, when you will sit by another fireside by the shores of Galilee on that resurrection breakfast occasion, and Jesus will cook tilapia fish by you, for you, to eat for breakfast, and you'll be restored. We'd like to tell him that right now, but we can't. He's in the darkness for the time being. But he will be a restored disciple one day, and he'll be told to go and look after the flock of Jesus Christ. There's a way back. There is a way back. And Peter remembered the earlier words of Jesus. I like Luke 22, verse 61, which amplifies all this by saying that at the point that Peter does the third denial, says he spotted Jesus, and Jesus turned and looked at him as the cock crowed. And there was surely a great life of restoration in that look. A great promise that Christ loved him still. I'm sure that's what it was. Not accusation, but, you know, not even I told you so, not even that. But it was a look that held Peter in all the darkness. It's been described as the talisman that broke the spell that held Peter captive. So the past suddenly came rushing back. All the life with Jesus that he'd gone through in the past 3 years. So even then, this was the beginning of the way back. The reshaping of Peter the fisherman into Peter the spearhead of the apostolic witness to Jesus. Peter got back, whereas Judas never got back. Peter's heart was always with Christ, whereas Judas always had that hidden agenda. So when we think about him, Peter, disorientated, distanced, disguised, dissociated, discredited, there's a way back. I mean, some of us, we found ourselves right here at that point with Peter. Maybe some of us right now. Use that breakfast. Let that be your restoration breakfast on April the 3rd, on that Tuesday morning. We could do that and bring our friends along as well. There is a way back. I close off with some nice words from an American song. So seeing Jay Bruce there. This is for you, Jay. Trials dark on every hand, and we cannot understand all the ways that God will lead us to that blessed promised land. But he'll guide us with his eye, and we'll follow till we die, and we'll understand it better by and by. Temptations, hidden snares, often take us unawares. And our hearts are made to bleed for each thoughtless word or deed. And we wonder why the test, when we've tried to do our best. We'll understand it better by and by. And when we do understand it, then we have the capacity to do as Peter did and come back to full strength and even be a rock person. Let's close with prayer. Teach us, Lord, from these superb and deep stories, this historical account of Christ, master of the world, himself in the dock. And help us, Lord, in this day when the spotlight is again and again focused on Christ to discredit him, that we may stand with him, for him, under him, all our days. We pray this for his name's sake.